Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Yeager, and welcome to another installment of the MTOM Show podcast. Guess what? We're in the Big Kid Studio today. We are going to have a conversation from the Market to Market set. This is going to be the full expanded version of what you saw on the most previous edition of the Market to Market TV show. This is going to be talking heavily about China. We're going to be talking with Iowa's former governor, Terry Branstad, who was President Trump's ambassador to China. What was that like? I mean, there were lots of things going on with China. We're going to talk about the COVID-19 virus that swept the world. We'll also talk about phase one trade. What's the role of an ambassador? Is it just somebody who goes and poses for pictures? We'll find out from Ambassador Branstad about being that go-between. What's life like in China? How was it that he had to make if he wanted to communicate with the White House or the administration? What was that like? We're also going to find out how he just can't shake the Iowa State Fair, how he brought pork chops on a stick to China. That's in this installment of the M2M podcast show. Enjoy. Which is a harder phone call to make? The one to say, honey, I'm going to run for governor again, or honey, the president called, he wants me to be ambassador to China. Which was a harder conversation at home?
Running for governor again in 2010. Because my wife said, you got a great job, it pays a lot more than being governor. Why in the world would you do that? So she said, are you crazy? But going to China, it's kind of interesting the way that happened, because right after the election, I led a trade mission to China and Japan. While I was gone, and there started to be speculation because President Trump had said at his last rally before the election in 2016 in Sioux City that, oh, Governor Branstad can take care of China for us. And then, you know, a lot of people didn't think he'd win the election. Then he wins the election, and then people started speculating about this, and they say, well, where's Governor Branstad? Well, he's in China. So then my two sons and daughter came to Terrace Hill and asked, told my wife, you know, if Dad gets the opportunity to be the ambassador to China, don't say no, because we'd like to go there too. And my daughter is there teaching now.
And they ended up coming along with you. Some of your family did, right?
My daughter, son-in-law, and two grandchildren, and they're back in China now teaching at the International School of Beijing.
What's the biggest difference for someone? I mean, we all follow a governor or a senator. I mean, a politician's a little different. You campaign and then you have to govern. You had to do both several times. Yeah. Are they similar jobs? Or are they different jobs?
Well, there's some similarity because, you know, you're dealing with people. And I focused as governor on economic development and education. And you still deal with those issues. In fact, you really, as ambassador, are helping Americans that are in China or businesses that are doing business there or trying to help people that run into problems while they're there. That's part of your issues, too, is somebody that gets in trouble and seeing what you can do to represent them. But the difference is, when you're governor, you're the chief executive. You are the final decision maker. When you're the ambassador, you are representing the United States of America and the administration. So you have to clear things with the Secretary of State or with the President of the United States, and sometimes I wanted to respond quicker to something the Chinese did, but I had to get it cleared in Washington. Sometimes that took days.
Well, and that's part of the CEO of a state.
Yep.
You set the policy and the sale, like
right.
You said. And if you heard a question in the morning from the press or you read something, you acted on it.
Yeah.
What would be the time frame, given there's time zones? And of course, there's always somebody staffed at Secretary of State around the clock. But how quickly could you respond to something that happened?
Well, there's a 12-hour difference, and that can be a problem, too. And then there's so much surveillance by the Chinese that if you want to have a confidential conversation, I'd have to go. The residence was 20 miles from the embassy, or 20 minutes from the embassy. I'd have to travel to the embassy, and it would usually be in the middle of the night because it's 12 hours difference. If I wanted to talk to the President, the Secretary of State, or Ambassador Lighthizer, who was the trade representative, or Secretary Mnuchin, Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, and I did have a lot of conversations with him, but obviously the time makes a difference. Plus, the Secretary of State, he had basically a policy that they had to clear everything in terms of us responding to something the Chinese might have done with regard to, say, Hong Kong or the mistreatment of the Uyghurs out in Xinjiang province. And that was a real problem because oftentimes we wanted to be able to move instantaneously. And I had my own public affairs people there to advise and help me. But by the time we'd get approval from D.C., it might be 2, 3, 4 days later. And that, unfortunately, with today's news cycles, that didn't work very well.
There's always the term career politicians, but you also had career diplomats that were there. And they're helpful, I would imagine, to allow you to come in and have a seamless of a transition, get a lay of the land. I mean, you had some familiarity with China, but what are those diplomats that you mentioned that would help you?
Well, first of all, the ambassador is the chief of mission. So everybody basically reports to you. And we had, when I first got there, we had 5 consulates. But then, of course, you know that we forced the Chinese to close their consulate in Houston, and they retaliated by forcing us to close our consulate in Chengdu. We also, because of the Wuhan virus, closed the consulate in Wuhan. And to my knowledge, that has not been reopened yet. So it's a challenge. And the neat thing is, we really all looked at ourselves as Team America in China, and we had all these career diplomats and 50 different agencies, all the military, CIA, the FBI, and every federal agency you can think of, but they all reported to me. And then I would meet with the leadership really 5 days a week.
The job, you say, I mean, ambassador, you really are bringing America to China, and you're also taking China back to the United States.
Yep.
Give me a misconception in both scenarios. What's the biggest misconception Americans have about the Chinese?
Well, China is a big and complicated country. Plus, it's a communist country, and so one-party totalitarian system. They don't have the freedoms that we have. Freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, and freedom of speech, all these things. And even while I was there, they had what they called the one country, two systems with Hong Kong because they had gotten it from Britain, and that was the agreement they had. They basically took that away. So because of the demonstrations in Hong Kong, they used that as an excuse to pass this national security law, which basically eliminated the freedoms of speech and religion and even independent judiciary. So now, even if you're a foreigner living in Hong Kong, you could be treated by mainland Chinese law. And that is very scary because it's not transparent. People just disappear for extended periods of time, and that was a very tragic thing that occurred.
The first time when you see something like that happen, the diplomats who had been there for a number of years had seen that. I mean, you've paid attention to China, but maybe not to that level of minutia that goes on. When you see something like that and you pass that back up through the channels, whether it's Secretary of State or back to the president, at what point... how quickly does policy dictate how you can respond and weigh in on something as Hong Kong? Because we see the Hong Kong story, and Americans sometimes don't understand why that's so important.
Well, that's one of the problems is, obviously, we report what we're seeing on the ground to the people at the State Department, to the White House, and they basically respond. But sometimes we would like to be able to do it ourselves. And then, of course, they have what they call the marshes, and that's where the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, would call me in if somebody in the administration or even somebody in the Congress, they might not even be in the majority, if they introduce something that the Chinese don't like or say something, they would chew me out about that. And then I would report that back to Washington, and then, of course, I would respond on me. And I had political people and economic people that would accompany me to those meetings, and then I would respond on behalf of the United States and the administration. But that's something that I wasn't quite aware of before I went over there, but I certainly learned to deal with that and to do it in a firm but diplomatic way.
Were you called over often?
Yes. Sometimes more than once a week.
And it could be from anything, maybe a Democrat said, a Republican said, in House, yeah, in the
absolutely.
Senate. Or what about the president? Because the president, President Trump had a lot of rhetoric on China,
yeah,
that he would do direct. And it might not, it appeared, maybe didn't go through the same diplomatic channels that you would have to go to. How hard was that fire to put out?
Well, the issue was more with Secretary of State Pompeo, because he took a hardline position again on China and insisted on fairness and reciprocity. They've been able to get by with a lot of things, and they don't treat us or they don't treat our reporters the same as we treat them. And he said, we're going to have fairness and reciprocity, and so you have to get approval from, if you want to meet with a university, you need to get approval from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and then the local provincial ministry, and even the one at the municipal level, and I might get approval 2 months in advance, and 2 days before the meeting, they'd say, oh, it's not convenient. Well, he said, we're going to start treating the Chinese the same way. We're going to make them at least give us notice. I don't think they required permission, but they required notice, and that was something, it was a big change. But the whole idea was we need to treat the Chinese the way they're treating us, and we need to insist on fairness and reciprocity and recognize them as a strategic competitor. And that's something I think it's very important the Biden administration do. And initially, during the campaign, Biden was saying, China's no problem. Now he's starting to say, no, we do need to recognize they're a strategic competitor. They have not been transparent and open about what happened in Wuhan, and it's just starting to come out now as the a year later, we finally have the World Health Organization going to Wuhan, but they're not seriously looking into the issue of the lab in Wuhan or some of the other issues. And it's so much later, trying to find out the origin of this pandemic is very hard.
I could have an entire list of just highlights of articles that volley back and forth about Wuhan virus, China virus, the U.S. virus, the U.S. military did this, some spy did that. When you see those headlines, how do you help sort through that and sift through that to make sense of these two people have got to figure out a way to get together and get close to the same page?
Well, it's very aggravating because initially there was a big cover-up. And the people at
on the Chinese side. Okay.
In fact, the people in Wuhan didn't want to report to Beijing or Xi Jinping what was happening. Because under their system, if something bad happens, bam, you get fired, you may go to prison. And so they covered that up, and you know, the initial doctor that discovered and whatever, he ended up dying of it, and they made him recant what he had said and all of this. And finally it got so bad that people in China were complaining about it, and then they sent in the People's Liberation Army to take it over. They even built new hospitals and did all kinds of things to try to bring it under control and won. But in the meantime, they had this big Lunar New Year celebration attended by thousands and thousands of people. And then they had the tradition of going out after that, and they went all over the world. And that's what really, in my opinion, created this worldwide pandemic.
So when you see certain things happening in Wuhan, you know, you hear what's going on. I mean, you've got people inside the embassy that can help you out, or at the State Department.
Well, we even had a consulate there, and when this was originally started,
it closed.
And then we were the first to evacuate our consulate and Americans from Wuhan, and other countries followed suit. But the Chinese were still denying it, and we were doing that in January of last year.
So should that have been an indication back home to the administration in Washington that this is a serious thing that could spread? And then how come the administration maybe was a little slower and Americans were a little slower in responding to it?
Actually, Trump was one of the first to say, we're going to restrict travel from China to the United States, except for Americans that we're bringing back. And they would also be quarantined when they came back from our consulate or from that area. But what was tragic, he did that, I think, maybe right at the end of January. Unfortunately, that was too late because so many people had gone from Wuhan to other parts of the world. And then, you know, then you had the big outbreak in Italy and other places where they'd gone. And then the Chinese tried to blame the United States military or the Europeans
still today,
or other
people. Yeah.
Well, it's amazing. Here we are more than a year later, and they're still putting out that false information. I think everybody knows it started in Wuhan. We will probably never know how it jumped from a bat or from an animal to human and then human to human transmission of it. But initially, even the WHO, which is essentially controlled by the Chinese, denied that there was human-to-human transmission. So there are a lot of mistakes that were made. It's brand new, difficult, and obviously we've paid a terrible price with death and economic disaster throughout the world.
At some point, we could talk about the virus for the rest of the time, but I want to get also at that same time that's going on, you're still trying to work through trade deals that are going to help American farmers. Is the same way the administration, I mean, they were very much, we are the only ones talking to the Chinese. We are not bringing in other countries. The multilateral approach to trade, it appeared from the outside looking at it, that we were going alone against China. Was that a good strategy?
Well, first of all, we are the largest economy in the world, and we have done more to help China to join the World Trade Organization and invested in China. So we've done a lot to help China. And this administration said, and the Chinese love to have these dialogues where you have these discussions that doesn't lead to anything. And they say, well, yeah, we're going to reform and open up. And then it gets delayed and delayed and delayed. And Ambassador Lighthizer, and initially I wasn't so sure about him, but I became very impressed with him. He is very focused, very meticulous. Not only did he get, and it took us 2 years, it was a long, hard battle, and we had to use tariffs to get their attention, but it worked. We did get their attention, and we got them to address longstanding issues like protecting intellectual property rights, preventing the stealing of technology like they have with corn seed here, and things like that, but also dramatically increasing a purchase of agriculture, energy, and manufactured goods from the United States. And of course, that agreement was signed in January, right before the pandemic really started, before we became aware of the Wuhan virus. But then, because of the virus, it got off to a slow start. It was signed in January, but it didn't take effect till mid-February, so about a year ago. But the Chinese have now purchased record amounts of corn, soybeans, pork, even beef and chicken. And the result has been the price of, ever since I think September, soybeans have gone up from about $9 a bushel to $14. Corn's gone up from $3 to $5.50. It's made a real difference for the price we're getting. And the prices are even higher in China.
But it is short of what the projections, or at least what the deal was. And
it's a two-year deal.
It's a two-year deal, and that's going to be a heck of a amount of purchases that are going to have to be made in this second year. Are they going to be able to do it?
Well, I think they're able to do it. The question is, do they have the will to do it? And the Biden administration needs to insist that they abide by what they committed to. Now, I think there's valid reasons why it got off to a slow start because of what was happening with the virus. But now they've caught up to a great degree in the fall. And they've done more on agriculture than they've done on energy or like aircraft from Boeing and things like that. So there's still a lot they need to do. But we need to not only do that, The other part that didn't get done, the phase one didn't include eliminating the subsidies of the state-owned enterprises, which really distorts the market. And that's what the new administration needs to focus on. That's what the Trump administration was planning to do in a second term.
Well, and the Chinese-owned companies have long been a source of look for them for signs, because that's usually an indication of what the government wants to do when it comes to buying soybeans or corn.
That's right. In fact, one of the last groups that I met with before I left China was COFCO. They are the biggest Chinese purchaser of agriculture products. So I made the point that they had made progress on a lot of things, but they hadn't purchased ethanol. And now they've made a commitment. They're going to make a record purchase of ethanol in 2021. We need to see that they do that. They need to do that to help reduce pollution. They're still using MTBE, which is poisoning the groundwater. So we've made some progress, and the embassy actually started monitoring air quality years ago, and that has helped convince the Chinese they need to get serious about air pollution. But they have a huge problem with both groundwater and soil pollution, and we can help them, and certainly ethanol and biodiesel, and for that matter, DDGs is great livestock feed. So I'm very hopeful we're going to see that, and that's one of the last things I did with both COFCO and with their chief negotiator, Liu He, before leaving China.
As we sit here tonight, is a phrase that we've said many a times on Market to Market, as we sit here today and have this discussion, Ambassador, has phase one been a success?
Oh, it's been a great success. Just ask the farmer who's seen their price of corn go up from $3 to $5.50. There's no question about that. It's not perfect, but it's a good first step, and we need to continue to move forward on that. China is a huge country with a huge population, and with the growing middle class, there's more and more demand for protein, and pork is there. And of course, they've been hit by the African swine fever, which they're really rebuilding their pork herd. And that's one of the reasons why they need the corn and soybeans.
Which is a concern if you're looking at the market from an outside perspective, not your inside perspective of what was going on over there, to say China needs to feed their people.
Right.
That's why they're buying. It just so happens it can fall under the umbrella of phase one.
Well,
is that
that's
an
true.
Accurate statement?
Well, yeah, I think that's true. But the Chinese people love the quality and the reliability of American food. Hormel, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Quaker Oats, all of those things are very popular with the Chinese consumer. And so I think we need to continue to press them to fulfill the commitments they've made. And it's in their interest as well, because frankly, what they're importing from us costs a lot less than their local prices in China.
Well, if it wasn't for agricultural products, the trade balance would be a bigger imbalance than it is right now.
Huge. There is significant opportunities, though, with LNG, natural gas, and that can be a long-term contract that can help reduce pollution. They're still heating with coal in a lot of places in China. Replacing that with LNG does a lot to reduce pollution, and it's very economical. We have the cheapest and reliable source. That's why I'm concerned about restrictions on these pipelines and America's drilling of natural gas and oil by this administration, because I think we've already seen the price of gas go up about 50 cents a gallon, and I'm really concerned that we don't want to take away the advantage that we have as being the world leader in natural gas and gasoline, oil.
Don Rose has said on this show a couple of times and told me recently, says the Chinese were the ones who invented trading. China has a history of saying they're going to order something. And then, as you said earlier, yes, we're going to do it, we're going to do it. No, we're not. They'll cancel an order. Price drops 10%. They swoop in, buy again. Is that a practice? Is that, I guess I ask you about misconceptions. Is that accurate about some of their ways of doing business?
And you know, they love to have what they call these dialogues. And we want results. We want to see action. We want to see contracts. We want to see purchases. They love to promise and then put off. But they also have a real problem because they had a bad crop this year. They have some real needs. And I'm going to tell you what, the price of pork is really important to the Chinese consumer. And when it gets too darn high, and they want stability and predictability, and they don't want to have any unrest among their people. So that's something the Chinese have to keep very close. They need to keep those things under control. And that's to our advantage because we are the low-cost, reliable supplier of those agriculture products.
There's been many reports from those who watch the hog industry in China saying they're rebuilding. But then just in the last month, we've seen reemergence of the virus. What is the Chinese farmer look like that's different to the American farmer? Because now you're seeing these hog lots. We have confinements here. They're stacking them on together. We call them the hog Hiltons. Is that accurately reported?
Well, it's a difference. When I first went there in 1984, I went out to a rural village, and they'd have maybe one sow in a pit. Now, and of course, it was still a lot of smaller operations until this African swine fever. But a lot of the new ones that are building now, like you say, are these mega operations. But, you know, they still have the problem with the African swine fever. Thank God it's not come here. But we have to be, that's why we haven't had the World Pork Expo in Iowa here the last year or so, because we want to do all we can to protect against this coming, because that's what happened in China. I think it came down from Russia to Heilongjiang province in the north, but then it ended up spreading through all of China. It's been a huge problem for the last 3 years.
What happens if the Chinese farmer gets better at doing things, like you said, not the one pig in a pit in the backyard, and they do get better at that? Are they going to still need us for things?
Yeah, I don't think that... I just don't think they have enough arable land, and of course they keep paving more areas, and you know they've had a big infrastructure, so they put all kinds of high speed rail and high speed highways and airports and everything, and that takes land out of production. So I think China is always going to be dependent, not just on the United States, Brazil, Argentina and other countries in the world as well. And of course, South America has had its issues this year with their crops as well because of the conditions.
It's been dry and now it's wet. It's been a problem. A couple of things here before we finish, Ambassador. I've got video of you with Premier Li and Ambassador Lighthizer, the trade rep, and other people that had events like that. What are those events like? They seem very formal, but most state events are. How different are they, and how big of a production is it, maybe for production's sake?
Well, the Chinese are really big into these very formal type events. So they'll take group pictures, but there's real negotiations that go on at these. And then there's follow-up with, and so we had 2 years of these, one round after another, and some in China, some in Washington, D.C., and I participated in a number of them, but Lighthizer and Mnuchin were the lead negotiators on our side, and Liu He was the lead negotiator on their side. They built a very good personal relationship and understanding. And Lighthizer not only was successful with the Chinese, but he also got a new, more favorable trade agreement with Japan, with South Korea, and with Canada and Mexico. So he did, in my opinion, a great job. He was very focused, very meticulous, and very detailed. And he also stayed in touch to oversee what was going on and encourage the Chinese to fulfill their commitments.
Were there times you had to play, I won't say middleman, but you had to get involved in negotiations, or do you leave that to the trade rep's office?
Well, I would be kind of a go-between, and I would share what we were hearing in China and share that with, and sometimes I would have to get up and at night and go in and call Lighthizer or Mnuchin. I actually built a very good personal relationship with him. Initially, not so much, but by the end, we were exchanging personal telephone numbers and emails and all of that, and I worked closely with him. Also, I had a great relationship with Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, and he's a great advocate for American agriculture, and you know, he's from Georgia, but he's involved with corn and soybeans, and he told me, don't think I'm just raising peanuts and cotton. I'm more into corn and soybeans, and he was. Well, and he was a great advocate for us on that.
Well, the family had to be involved with the poultry operation that they had. All right. Which was the best part of the job for you as ambassador?
I think it was the people we got to meet. First of all, you know, as governor, I helped start the sister state relationship with Hebei province. And we had built a lot of friends there. And they almost treat me like a rock star when I go to Hebei because I was the one that signed the sister state. And so they look at me as an old friend and whatever. So I have a lot of friends there. But I also got to know a lot of the ambassadors from other countries that were stationed there. And especially as we went through the pandemic, my wife and I worked closely with the ambassadors and their spouses. And we did social things with them and worked closely with them. So we made a lot of friends, and I also tried to get to every province. They have provinces, and they have some what they call autonomous regions. We got to 26 of them before the virus cut down on the travel.
Sounds like a campaign event, campaign style of getting to the all, pulling a full Grassley, getting to all 99 counties.
Well, that was my goal, not in 1 year, but trying to do it during the time I was there. But the problem, and that was a way to try to learn about China, and it's very different. I mean, so we did get to Tibet, mountainous area out in the southwest. We got up to Heilongjiang province, which is one of their best agriculture regions. We were up there for their big ice festival with our grandchildren. And it just so happens the party secretary in Heilongjiang used to be the governor of Hebei. And so he treated us unbelievably well because I knew him from his previous assignment. Unlike the United States, the party secretaries and the governors are not elected at the local level. They're chosen by the leadership in Beijing and sent to different areas of the country. So you might be a party, you might be a governor in a small province, and if you do well, then you might get promoted to be a party secretary in a bigger, more prosperous part of China.
Good left-handed reliever out of the Midwest League gets called up to the Pacific Coast League to go play in the big club. All right.
That's the way their system works. Very different than ours. As you know, here you kind of come up through the ranks within your state if you want to eventually become the governor.
You mentioned party. And I want to end on this. You mentioned before we started rolling today, you did have one good gathering at the embassy in that area. You just can't shake the Iowa State Fair.
No, and we did this twice. But the last one, because of the COVID virus, we had to cancel our normal 4th of July big national day. So we rescheduled it for Constitution Day, September 17th, which is also Chuck Grassley's birthday. And that was one of the biggest events that was held, and we did it outdoors at our embassy with the state fair theme. We even had pork chop on a stick. We had the wheat producers produced a huge cake. We had popcorn, and we had, I think, 700 people. We're only supposed to have 500, but I think we had about 700 people at that gathering. Beautiful day, beautiful weather. People had a great time, and that was one of the last events that I hosted on September 17th, and then I came back here. And we got all the people that we'd evacuated because of the virus. We'd evacuated the United States, over 1,300 people, and we got them all back to China before Chris and I came back here on October 5th.
I did forget. There's one more thing I did want to ask you. You did kind of indicate. This is now that you've had. You mentioned you've been back since October, so you've had some time to reflect. The Biden administration. You've talked about some of the things they should do.
Yeah.
Give them a final. Hey, this is what I saw from where I sat. This is what I think is important to do. You've kind of already indicated it, but is there something other than holding their feet to the fire? I mean, is it maybe we should bring in some other countries to help?
They're trying to do that. First of all, they need to treat China as a strategic competitor, and they need to do what we started to do and has to be done, and that is insist on fairness and reciprocity in the relationship and not just say, oh, we'll go back to these endless dialogues which lead to no particular action. We need to be action-oriented and focused. We also need to continue to hold their feet to the fire and insist that the WHO do a really objective evaluation of where how this virus started. We know it started in Wuhan, but we really don't know more than that. And they continue to even deny that it started in Wuhan. And so we can't let them get by with that. We need to. Other countries have the same feelings about that. They've tried to blame the Europeans. They've tried to blame everybody else but the Chinese for this. And we need to insist that there be an international effort to get to the bottom of it and hopefully prevent this kind of thing from happening again.
Ambassador Terry Branstad, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
My thanks to Ambassador Terry Branstad for his time as we discuss China. If you have any feedback for us, hit us up at markettomarket@iowapbs.org. That's an email, or you can send me an email at paul.yeager@iowapbs.org. Thank you so very much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.